Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, October 10, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone topic is the Take Care Clause and the President's Duty to Defend Federal Law. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Very happy to welcome to today's call two experts. We're going to hear from each of them in turn, beginning with Kurt Levy. Kurt A. Levy is the President and Executive Director of the Committee for Justice. He's going to speak for about 8 to 10 minutes, giving his opening remarks, and then we'll hear from Professor Neil E. Devins. He's Goodrich Professor of Law, Cable Research Professor, and the Professor of Government, and the Director of the Institute of Bill of Rights Law, and Director of the Election Law Program at William & Mary School of Law. And with that, Mr. Levy, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thank you, Dean. You know, this is a good week to talk about this because gay marriage has been in the news, and it's really gay marriage that has put the focus on whether a president or a state attorney general has the duty to defend laws. First happened. The spotlight in 2011 when the Obama administration decided not to defend the Defense of Marriage Act's traditional definition of marriage against a constitutional court challenge, even though strong arguments could be made in its defense. And then the issue has been at the forefront again more recently when state attorney generals have refused to defend their state's bans on same-sex marriage. I won't get into the duty of state AGs, but I did want to acknowledge that, it's a related issue. The duty to defend federal statutes springs from the Take Care Clause in the Constitution, which says that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And execution of laws is, of course, the primary duty of the executive, hence the name executive. And that duty extends even to laws that he doesn't like. Take Care Clause was in part a reaction to the English Crown's royal prerogative, which gave the king the power to nullify Parliament's laws by suspending their execution. So the king did not have that duty to faithfully execute. And executing laws has two components, enforcement and defense. People typically talk about the enforcement duty more, But enforcement means little if, the object of the enforcement can challenge the constitutionality of the law and get no resistance from government. I should add that in our view, a duty to defend requires a robust defense, not a half-hearted defense, but one in which the administration makes the best possible arguments in the law's defense. And that view is the widely held majority view now, but we'll see what happens going forward. Obama's success in really getting away with the non-defense of DOMA may encourage future presidents to do the same, and they'll be able to point to excellent papers by Neil and his colleague Sai Prakash to justify a weaker or non-existent duty to defend. So let me review why the majority view, I think, is right. For one, it prevents the president from enacting a form of post-enactment veto of legislation that he dislikes, thus doing an end run around the democratic process. Now, I know, Neil doesn't see this as a problem, and he tries to distinguish it from the English Crown's power of suspension by saying that the president can only decline to enforce when he believes a law is unconstitutional, so the president is still bound by the Constitution. But I'm more of a cynic. I see that as more of a formality than a real constraint, and I'm especially skeptical with a president like Obama, for whom the political system, for whom the political seems to be everything. Here's a president who went overnight from saying he supported traditional defense to I'm sorry, he supported a traditional definition of marriage to saying that a traditional definition is unconstitutional. So, you know, hard to know what he really believes. A strong duty to defend, like the judicial doctrine of stare decisis, provides stability and predictability to the rule of law. We have a whole section in our article dealing with parallels and common principles between stare decisis and the duty to defend. Don't have time for that here. But just imagine, you know, if the election of a new president set off a free-for-all in which the new president determined, you know, which laws were constitutional and which ones weren't. I mean, that just seems like a recipe for chaos rather than stability in the rule of law. A strong duty to defend also strengthens the separation of powers, not just by forcing the president to give a presumption of constitutionality to laws enacted by Congress and signed by a previous president, but also with regard to the judiciary's role. You know, when the president defends, that gives you the adversity of parties necessary to make the case justiciable and get a constitutional resolution from the courts. You know, Windsor, the DOMA case, is a good example of where that almost didn't happen. The court was split on whether the intervention of the House cured the adversity problem caused by the administration and the plaintiff being on the same side. You know, but what if the House was in Democratic hands or didn't want to get involved or its motion to intervene was denied by the district court? You know, I might have been happier if it didn't reach the Supreme Court, given the opinion Kennedy wrote. But, you know, I think from a separation of powers perspective, you know, this is a the constitutionality of a traditional definition of marriage is a question that needed to be answered. And it's the job of the judiciary, you know, according to since Marbury, to make that determination, whether I like it or not. I know that Neil argues that separation of powers requires the opposite, that the president make his own constitutional determinations. But, you know, as the head of an organization whose, you know, mission is fighting judicial activism, my emotions probably go the same way as Neil would go. I mean, there's something very appealing about the president giving the back of his hand to an imperial judiciary. But, you know, look, as I said, it's been the judiciary's role for 200 years. And if the framers gave us both the separation of powers and the duty to faithfully execute. So I don't think they thought that the two were inconsistent in any way. There are two generally recognized exceptions to the duty to defend that have been articulated by U.S. attorney generals going back at least to Civiletti under Carter. One is, I'll call it the transparently unconstitutional exception. There is some tension between the take care clause and the oath that requires the president to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. As Neil points out, you know, the president wouldn't be doing that if he tried to defend something that's unconstitutional. But, you know, we think, and the USAG has thought that, you know, it's got to be something transparently unconstitutional, that exception is enough to resolve any tension between the take care clause and the oath, president's oath. There's also an exception for laws that the president believes unconstitutionally encroach on executive power. And this is a non-controversial exception, and it springs from the fact that, you know, only the president can challenge laws on the basis that they encroach on executive power. If the president had to defend such laws, there'd be no check on encroachment and no legal challenge to spur a judicial determination of whether they really do unconstitutionally encroach. The most famous example there is INS v. Chadha, which involved the legislative veto provision in the Immigration and Nationality Act. Now, I said that, you know, AGs since Civiletti have pretty much agreed on you know, these two exceptions and the narrowness of the transparently unconstitutional exception. But, you know, Holder, you know, seems to have set forth a a new standard. He seems to have dramatically widened that first exception, perhaps to the point of swallowing the rule, both through the language that Holder used and the result that he reached. He expressed the standard more in terms of reasonable arguments instead of plausible ones, saying that the administration didn't have to make arguments it didn't think was reasonable. But if there were no reasonable arguments to defend DOMA before Windsor, then unreasonable must just mean, arguments the administration doesn't approve of, at which point the duty to defend is really eviscerated. Now, it's hard to know if this is a serious attempt at reformulating the standard or it's just an aberration motivated by the politics of gay marriage. I mean, we certainly hope it's sui generis rather than a permanent change to the standard. And, let's face it, a lot will depend on politics. I mean, if it's a future Republican administration refusing to defend Obamacare against, say, a religious liberty or other constitutional challenge, we suspect it'll be harder for the administration to get away with. Finally, let me point out that the duty to defend does not require the administration to remain quiet about its views. If the president, feels really strongly that the traditional definition of marriage is unconstitutional, he can certainly use his bully pulpit to explain that view to the nation. He can press Congress to repeal DOMA, and he can certainly adjust the enforcement of a law he believes to be unconstitutional, within the bounds allowed by the statute. In conclusion, I think the importance of the Take Care Clause and its duties to enforce and defend, can't be overstated. I mean, more than any other constitutional provision, it makes the president the servant of the law rather than its master. And when the president faithfully discharges that duty to defend, in some sense, he can't lose. Because if the law is truly unconstitutional, the courts will vindicate the president by striking it down. On the other hand, if the courts uphold the statute, the president can rest assured that the law was determined to be constitutional only after the sort of thorough consideration of arguments on both sides that happens best when the administration defends the law and provides adversity. So, this is the majority view, and we feel strongly that it should remain the standard. Neil, I know you feel very differently. What are your thoughts?
Thank you, Kurt. That was an excellent presentation of the view that the president really does have a near absolute duty to defend, and thank you for that. I do disagree, and let me start by saying that the issue of the federal duty to defend needs to be separated from the state duty to defend, and I'm going to focus in on the federal, and in the Q&A, if people want to talk about the state, we can do that. But with respect to the state duty, it's defined by state law, and each state has its own constitution and its own set of statutes governing state attorney generals, and in some states there might be an absolute or near absolute duty to defend, and in other states there might be no duty to defend at all. So the debate today over attorney general enforcement or non-enforcement or defense or non-defense of same-sex marriage bans is really a function of state law and is not subject to a one-size-fits-all generalization. With respect to the U.S. Attorney General and the federal duty to defend, I do take issue with some of the things that Kurt had said, although clearly some of his concerns are certainly legitimate, and in the Q&A we can tease those out if people are interested. On the issue of the Constitution and what the Constitution means, with respect to the Take Care Clause, in our article, Sai, Prakash, and I argue that the president only has a duty to take care of the execution of law, and by law, something must be constitutional. If something is not constitutional, it's not law, and the president need not execute it. Along these lines, we very much agree with how President Thomas Jefferson approached the Alien and Sedition Acts, which punished people for libelous speech against the government, by saying that violated the First Amendment, and notwithstanding the fact that people had been convicted under the statute and sentenced to jail under it, he would treat the statute as a nullity, and he would pardon all those who had been convicted under it. We think that's the right approach for the president to exercise his authority to interpret the Constitution and refuse to enforce that which is written as law that he considers not law at all. I think the main difference with respect to what Kurt was saying is that in the view of Cy and I in the article we wrote, we think that the separation of powers requires that the president not simply adhere to Supreme Court interpretations of the Constitution, but have the authority to interpret the Constitution him or herself. And the duty to defend, if it's pursued absolutely, essentially says that the president ought to simply let the courts decide what the Constitution means, and we do not want to leave that decision in the president's hand, where the president would act on his own interpretation. I think that's the principal disagreement with respect to the constitutional question. And then on the practical issues, there are a range of practical questions with respect to what happens if the president has the authority not to defend. And I'll just make a couple of points here, because I really do think our time should focus on listener questions. One is that this issue is going to come up very infrequently. The fear that the Attorney General will all of a sudden start pursuing his authority, the president's authority, that is, and refusing to defend a slew of law, just doesn't seem true. Notwithstanding the fact that Attorney General Holder, as Kurt noted, has a very broad view of presidential authority in this area, there really aren't examples outside of the DOMA of the DOJ not defending federal law, and other attorney generals have also recognized an authority not to defend, not as broad as Attorney General Holder, and the examples in which there are non-defenses over time are just few and far between. And the reason for this is that the Department of Justice gains power by controlling government litigation, gains power by having the Supreme Court and the federal courts having very significant authority in our governmental system. The authority of the Justice Department is very much tied to the authority of the federal courts. There's very little incentive for the Justice Department to pursue some constitutional vision which would result in the non-defense of federal statutes. So these examples of cases where the president will not defend or the attorney general will not defend are few and far between. I don't think there's great risk of seeing proliferation of these cases. I think things are different at the state level, and the incentives of the attorney general are different. We can talk about that later if people are interested. A second way I'll take issue with Kurt, and this will be my final point for now, is that if you have a standard which Kurt embraces, which is to say that the attorney general need not defend that which is clearly unconstitutional, that still gives interpretive power to the attorney general. If the attorney general wants to do mischief with that standard, the attorney general can do mischief. And in the article that Cy Prakash and I wrote, one of the things we do is to talk about how malleable this clearly unconstitutional standard had been in the hands of different attorney generals. So we see when there are changes of administrations, there's always an example of a non-defense on the grounds of something being clearly unconstitutional. So the Reagan administration disagrees with the Carter administration. The Clinton administration agrees with the first Bush administration. The first Bush administration disagrees with the Clinton administration. The Obama administration disagrees with the Bush administration. In each administration, there seems to be a case, but really only one case, as it turns out, in which an attorney general has said, we're going to reverse the position of the Department of Justice because, unlike the previous Justice Department, we think this law is clearly unconstitutional. And that just speaks to the fact that if you give any interpretive independence to the attorney general will act on it. And it also speaks to the fact that having a broader power in the president is not likely to yield many instances of non-defense, as revealed in the fact that these cases come up so infrequently. So I'll just leave it at there for now and open it up to questions, unless Kurt would like to have some type of response to what I just said.
Yeah, let me respond to a few things. I agree that, statute is not law if it's not constitutional, but I think that only applies, again, where something is transparently unconstitutional. It's still law even if the president, feels it's constitutional, and I stress feels it's unconstitutional, and I stress feels. You mentioned that non-defense is examples are few and far between, and I would argue that's because there is a strong duty to defend, in the views of the U.S. Attorney Generals, certainly in recent decades. And I think we'll see more examples of non-defense now that Holder has sort of set this precedent. It may still be few, but I worry that it'll be on blockbuster issues like gay marriage, because that's where there's a lot of political points to gain. And you mentioned that even the transparently unconstitutional standard is malleable, and it is certainly somewhat malleable. But why make it more malleable? That's my feeling. The fact that it's malleable already, probably gives presidents enough discretion. Certainly, some attorney generals have envisioned, a very, very narrow exception with not a lot of malleability. Civiletti, for example, gave an example of a law where, that ordered the arrest and imprisonment of all members of the opposition party. So they envisioned a very narrow exception. And the malleability maybe makes it a little broader, but why make it, so broad that it's really standardless and it eviscerates the duty to defend? Those are the only points I wanted to respond to.
Terrific. Professor Devens, did you want to offer any further remarks, or should we turn to the audience?
Why don't we turn to the audience?
Okay. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that announcement, if you have a question for either of our experts today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got plenty of time left for questions. Let me make just a general announcement urging folks to visit the Federal Society website for a schedule of upcoming teleforum conference calls. We have, I think, at least two of them scheduled for next week, but check our website for details and obviously look for the email announcements next week. Let's go to our first caller. We've got two caller questions pending, so let's check in with our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. When I review the statutes, I find no statute that requires the AG or any other federal official to defend the statute in court. Faithfully executing the laws is not faithfully executing statutes, which may not be laws, and execution is generally understood as an executive function where that you're applying force or to people outside of government or perhaps the government agents, but generally when you enter the courtroom, you are as a prosecutor, you're functioning as a judicial officer and not as an executive officer, even though this may be pursuant to executing a law. We allow for discretion in the execution of laws when there are not insufficient resources to execute them all, as certainly has been the case for well over a century. So if we allow for discretion, then we have to allow for discretion over whether to defend a statute in court. Now, the court may invite someone to argue that position. He could draw that person from the Justice Department, or he could draw it from an outsider, perhaps to be paid by the Justice Department. But that would be a function for the court to do rather than for the AG's office to do. And even the AG decided to perform the service because they are, after all, being paid to do it. There's no reason why they couldn't argue both sides, or even if more than two sides, and saying, okay, here are the arguments for, here are the arguments against, and by the way, we agree with the plaintiff who's challenging constitutionality. And on the point of presumption of constitutionality, that is itself unconstitutional. The Constitution must presume unconstitutionality. Any claim for an exercise of power must be strictly proved. And if it cannot be proved, it must be presumed to be unconstitutional.
Who wants to respond?
Well, let me start with one point, and then perhaps Kurt would like to add to it. This is Neil Devins again. The caller raises many interesting points, one of which is the notion of judicial authority to appoint counsel. And this is very important in the duty to defend question. If we assume that the president will execute the law but not defend the law, as was true with the Obama administration in the Defense of Marriage Act case, there is an adversarial dispute between the individual challenging the law and the fact that the law is still being applied to them, even if the Justice Department is not defending it. And in that instance, the court, even in a situation where, say, the House does not intervene, without getting into the legal questions whether the House can intervene in the Defense of Marriage Act case, courts can appoint counsel adversary, and they often do so to deal with issues in which there is no counsel presenting the argument. This came up in the Affordable Care Act case, for example, on some of the issues where there was no adversary to present the argument. The court appointed counsel, and the court also appointed in the Defense of Marriage Act case, I believe, Vicki Jackson, or maybe that was the Affordable Care Act case. In any event, Vicki was appointed in one of the cases to deal with issues that were not being pursued by counsel in the case. So the fact that the executive is enforcing but not defending means that there still might be a judicial resolution. And indeed, Sinai in our article said that there is no way of supporting the duty to defend, in part for this reason. We took it a step further and we questioned whether there was even a duty to execute, but our focus here is the duty to defend. So, Kurt, would you like to make additional comments with respect to the caller?
Sure. Certainly, a special counsel provides an important role in giving strong arguments, but you still need an adverse party to make the case justiciable. And the caller, mentioned that the government can make arguments for and against, and I suppose that would still fulfill the duty. But again, there's the problem of justiciability. If at the end of the day the administration is announcing that it's not defending the constitutionality of the law, it says we think it's unconstitutional, but we want the case to go forward, as it did in Windsor, that very much endangers whether there will be a decision on the merits. Just to give, I gave the Windsor example. On the same day, we had a second example, albeit involving a state AG's duty to defend. The Supreme Court in Hollingsworth said it couldn't reach the merits of California's Prop 8, the same-sex marriage ban, because the state refused to appeal the district court loss. And then we wound up with an irregular situation where the district court ruling decided the issue for 30 million Californians. So Neil is certainly right that sometimes when the administration won't defend, you still wind up with adverse parties and the issue gets decided. But sometimes it stands in the way, as it did in the Prop 8 case and almost in the Windsor case. If not every issue has to be decided by the courts, but where there is a constitutional challenge, we do think that separation of powers, argues that the president should not stand in the way of there being a judicial determination. I guess the last thing I'll say is, when you talked about selective enforcement, sometimes that's politically motivated. Other times it's just that, the government doesn't have infinite resources. Enforcement is a much bigger job than defending. But I think that the Justice Department and other agencies do have a big enough budget to defend constitutional challenges. They're not that many it has to limit them because of resources. Again, if it limits it may be may be because of genuine concerns about constitutionality, but it also may be, you know, because of politics.
We've got three questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hello, all. This is Steve McCloskey. I'm an attorney in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and really enjoying the topic and the speakers. You're both great. This is sort of a tangential issue, but the Constitution says that the law shall be faithfully executed by the president, and I know the focus of the discussion is on defending the constitutionality, but I wonder if you both could briefly touch on the topic of when the president, for example, with the Affordable Care Act, when he does not implement the dates specified in the act, or, for example, with the DREAM situation, the immigration kids who are here, and he chooses to enforce or not to enforce certain aspects of that. It's not that he's constitutionally refusing to challenge the constitutionality in court. He's just refusing to faithfully execute the laws. Thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Neil.
Sure. I'll be very brief, and I know this is of great concern to Kurt and part of the motivation of his article. And on this one, I think we agree. If the president thinks a law is constitutional, then he has an obligation to execute the law. I mean, there's a separate question of what does the law mean, and is the president acting within his power to read the law? And there is some discretion. Laws are not always clear. There's a dispute right now involving the Affordable Care Act and whether tax breaks can go to individuals who get health care through federal rather than state subsidies. And that's a legitimate question of whether the president is interpreting and implementing the law correctly or incorrectly. But if the president has a clearly written law and thinks the law is constitutional, he has a clear obligation to enforce it.
I guess I would say that while I am cynical that presidents will only not defend when they sincerely think something is clearly unconstitutional, I guess the good news, and where I'd have to agree with Neil, is there are plenty of cases where it wouldn't even pass the laugh test for the president to say it's unconstitutional, and that's true with the dates. You know, he didn't bother saying, you know, because it would be laughable that, you know, the dates were unconstitutional, and that's why he wasn't enforcing them. So, you know, ultimately you're pointing out that, you know, this president has weakened the duty to faithfully execute both on the defense side and the execution side. And again, I hope this is not a green light for a future president to do the same. You know, I've tried to point out to my progressive friends that, you know, they may not like the results. You know, there are still challenges to Obamacare, and, you know, some of them are big enough that you could argue that the whole law should be struck, you know, that the challenge provision is not severable. And so, you know, with a Republican president in office and no duty to defend, you may, you know, progressives may come to regret this weakening of the duty to enforce and defend.
Thank you both.
Once again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Chris Green from Ole Miss. I have a couple things. First, I'm curious about the state constitutional history. I know the state constitutional history for issues like judicial review is an important, I mean, that's the big source of historical support for judicial review and presumption of constitutionality and all that. I'm very curious what the history is. The state constitutions, of course, most of them have a splintered executive, so that would be a different issue, but the, still just the, what the word executive power means or the like would be a really important history. Secondly, I'm curious from Kurt what he would say about this argument. If the president is actually making an assertion when he says this law is constitutional, it would be odd to say that a president who merely thought it was I mean, so take a president who thinks it's probably unconstitutional, but not palpably so. I mean, one way to still have a duty to defend would be to say something like, well, when the president says it in court or the AG says it in court, he's not really saying it. It's not expressing his beliefs. So you don't apply the normal standards of, you know, you have to know what you're talking about in order to make assertions. They just sort of say, well, this is, you know, kind of preface everything with saying, you know, this is an argument that could be made, you know, colon, and then the argument, which kind of would be a little odd, I think. So I'm curious what you, how, you know, what you do with that.
Let me quickly answer that, then I'll give the state AG question to Neil because he's the expert. Again, you have a problem of adversity. If I understand you correctly, you're talking about the president saying, we think this is unconstitutional, but here are the arguments that could be made. Again, that puts us in the position that we had in Windsor, which was you didn't have adverse parties but for the House intervening. I guess before I throw it to Neil, I should also say that, well, he's the expert on state constitutions and therefore you know, and you know, you can, it's hard to give an answer that applies to all states. I think some of the same concerns apply on the state level, which is, you know, separation of powers, rule of law, justiciability of constitutional challenges. And with that, let me turn it over to Neil.
Sure. Thank you. So just a couple of things about state constitutions and state attorney generals. To start, state constitutions essentially never address the question of the obligations of the Attorney General to defend state law. And Sai Prakash and I have a forthcoming piece on state attorney generals and the duty to defend. And we looked at state constitutions, state law, state attorney general opinions. And with respect to state constitutions, they're largely silent, and to the extent there is language, the language is ambiguous, but most state constitutions do not address the issue at all. In terms of the state attorney general, as the caller noted, the state attorney general is not part of a unitary executive. State attorney generals in 43 states are elected. So the decision to enforce and the decision to defend are really separated at the state level, unlike the federal level where you have a unified executive and in theory the president calls the shots on both questions. And with respect to the state attorney general, you know, I think each state does have its own law and the attorney general's obligations are different in different states. So in Tennessee, for example, the state statutes specify that the attorney general is to independently interpret and act at his discretion. And there, I don't think there's any question that an attorney general can refuse to defend on the basis that he thinks a law is unconstitutional. In other states, the duty is absolute, and there seems to be no exceptions to it. And there, even in a case of something that seems patently unconstitutional, the exception Kurt noted before, if a state statute mandates that the state attorney general is obligated to defend under any circumstances, no matter what, I don't think there are any exceptions to that. As it turns out, the state system is much different with respect to issues of justiciability. If we think about state courts, the political question doctrine, issues of adversity, standing are just very different at the state court level. So here is an example that for those unfamiliar with the state system may seem rather shocking, but is quite true. Under the common law, state attorney generals have the power to represent the people, an independent power. They're not part of the executive branch. And that power extends to the ability to go into court and argue that a state law is unconstitutional on state constitutional grounds, and because state justiciability doctrine is so different than federal justiciability doctrine, state courts will typically entertain these lawsuits, and often the state secretary of state will stand in to defend a state statute under attack by the state attorney general. So the state system is just fundamentally different than the federal system on this question.
Thank you very much.
We've got two questions pending now. Again, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, this is Jim Haynes. I'm a member of the Federalist Society. And I was not able to listen in at the early part of the call, so I'll apologize in advance if you've already covered this and I just didn't hear it. But at a very general level, I wanted to ask our experts what, if anything, you think the effect is on the legitimacy and prestige of the courts, and particularly the Supreme Court. Presidents of the United States simply choose not to show up, not to send lawyers, to ignore judicial proceedings. I'm sure they'd be very nice about it, but essentially to deny the authority of the court in a way, and simply say that these matters have been resolved by me and the executive branch. There is perhaps a kind of an ongoing collapse of judicial review. Maybe that's too grandiose a word, but the emergence of signing statements out of White Houses now, and everybody seems to be doing it, where presidents prejudge construction and the constitutionality of laws that they're going to sign, essentially putting Congress and the courts on notice that at least as far as the executive branch is concerned, it means this, and we're not going to really trouble ourselves to go to Article III courts to try to figure out what it means. Of course, in a more informal way, what comes to mind for me is the actions of the executive branch in a Minneapolis, housing case that was headed for the Supreme Court and would have involved the court deciding the constitutionality of disparate impact analysis. And apparently the administration went ahead and engineered a settlement of that case to deny the court the opportunity to hear it. So my question is, do these things taken together cause you to think that there's kind of an ongoing, over the last few years, change in the status and legitimacy of the courts, as opposed to a focus on the president's duty, the legitimacy of the courts? Are we going to care as much about the courts as a way of resolving disputes?
Well, you know, I don't know that I've seen a decline of judicial review, although maybe what you're saying is that, what Holder has done with DOMA is setting us on that course. I'm not sure what you meant by not showing up in court, but certainly the idea that the president has an independent duty to determine constitutionality, which is what Neil advocates. I mean, certainly that is weakening the judiciary's role. And again, part of me likes that. I don't like what I often see as an imperial judiciary, but again, there is Marbury, and I guess the thought of a president who can just, as soon as he takes office, eviscerate a bunch of laws that he doesn't agree with, I guess that scares me more than the imperial judiciary. You mentioned signing statements, and certainly some people have constitutional problems with that, but at least that comes at the time of signing. I think the duty to defend is in a sense more important, because we have a line that legislation that's already been signed by a president, probably a previous president, and this president comes along and instead of deferring to the Congress and the previous president with regard to the constitutionality of law, he presumes that his judgment is better. So I find that more offensive than at least the president saying, okay, I'm signing this, but I have some reservations.
A couple of observations. One, and this is observation that you have to pay attention. It's essentially the same point, that you have to pay attention to how things will play out on the ground sometimes, rather than how things are stated abstractly and imagine and extrapolate from that what could happen. So with respect to signing statements, presidents often assert that provisions of law are unconstitutional when signing, signaling that they won't enforce those provisions. But when it hits the ground, the reality is that presidents go ahead and enforce the offending provisions. They do not treat them as a nullity and sign a law and then essentially item veto provisions they dislike by refusing to enforce. On the duty to defend issue, I think much the same is true. You can extrapolate from Attorney General Holder's statements, as Kurt did and did very well, and say that this raises the specter of presidents refusing to defend on a somewhat regular basis and undermining the rule of law as a result. But on the ground, attorney generals are not going to act on that authority. And the reason for that in particular, and I mentioned this before, so I'll be very quick here, is that the Justice Department's power hinges on its ability to get into court and make legal arguments. That's where their power lies. And if their power lies there, they're not going to shoot that in the foot by annoying the courts, undermining their authority in the courts, keeping away from the courts some key issues by claiming that the law is unconstitutional and will not be defended. And I think that's a big part of the reason that the duty to defend is advocated historically by the Justice Department, because it's good for them. It gives them power. And it also explains why instances in which presidents and the Justice Department will claim that there is no duty in a particular case are so few and far between.
Thank you.
Very good. We've still got two questions pending. I think we've got time for a third, even, if you'd like to put yourself in the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another caller.
Excellent presentation, gentlemen. This is Roger Candelaria, and my question is, maybe I missed it, but I would like for both of you to opine as to whether or not Kurt Levy's description of the reason why this provision was put in the Constitution is correct, and if so, is it still applicable? That is, if the purpose of the provision was to do away with the king's ignoring laws in England, or in the United States, when he was king of the United States too, I guess, if that was the purpose, then is that purpose being addressed by the positions that you're taking today?
I just want to clarify that I said that was one of the things that inspired the Take Care Clause. I don't think that was the only thing. And I think the Take Care Clause has prevented that problem. You know, who knows about alternate history, what we would have wound up with without that. But I think presidents have felt a duty to faithfully execute the laws. I'm not sure what you mean by has that purpose gone away. I mean, I think, you know, still to this day, we don't want an imperial presidency. Like I said, I think the Take Care Clause is the most important thing in the Constitution with regard to making a president the servant of the law and enforcing the rule of law. Neil?
I have nothing to add. I think that's a very good answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have for now what is our last call. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Otherwise, let's take this call.
Yes, it's David Emerson, Society member here in Berkeley, California. Interesting presentation. I've got a question, actually two questions briefly for the experts here. The first is, do either of you have any concern about forcing the duty to defend upon a executive that might present kind of a weak-kneed defense, in effect tossing the game, and the consequences of that versus not defending it at all? And the other question has to do with whether, as part of the justification for refusing to defend, and this is something I haven't heard, is whether or not, you know, part of the underlying concern is that the wheels of justice are just turning too slowly. And if that were the case, is there really an opportunity to explore something along the lines of a preliminary injunction type of standard to get at the transparently unconstitutional cases where you take into account substantial likelihood of success, balance of the harms, that type of thing, and basically have your cake and eat it, go in for the preliminary injunction, and then later, perhaps years later, get a definitive result?
In terms of a weak-kneed defense, I said that in our view, I think the duty to defend includes the duty to make the strongest possible arguments. One can argue around the margins, I think if we saw a half-hearted defense, we would know it. As to I really didn't understand your second question, so maybe I'll throw that to Neil.
I wasn't so sure of the second question as well. Maybe the caller would like to return with that. I don't think there would be a weak need defense if a defense was launched, in that the Justice Department's attorneys, you know, would certainly adhere to their professional obligations to represent their client vigorously. With that said, I do think it's possible that a Justice Department would not advance every conceivable argument available to it. And along those lines, there have been instances where the Supreme Court has appointed counsel adversary. And let me just give one example of that. And it's actually a non-defense case, but I think it makes the point reasonably well. The Clinton Justice Department would not defend the legislation overturning Miranda v. Arizona. At the same time in the case, they claim that whether Miranda was good or bad law was beside the point because the criminal defendant was guilty for other reasons. So they were quite willing to be vigorous advocates on behalf of the government while they were unwilling to defend the statute. So I think in an instance like that, and this is what happened in the Dickerson case, the Supreme Court went ahead and they appointed actually Paul Cassell to say that the Miranda statute, the Miranda override, was constitutional, notwithstanding the non-defense. So there would have been two reasons that the criminal defendant would have been in a bad spot, one for the reasons the Justice Department asserted, and a second for the reasons that Paul Cassell asserted that the Justice Department would not. So I do think the weak defense is not likely to occur, although arguments may not be made on behalf of one side by the government, and then the court can appoint counsel to handle that when that occurs.
Let me add, Neil sort of points out that it's, you know, there are complications. It's not always quite as clear-cut as, you know, I've made it out to be about either defend or not defend. And, you know, for the sake of honesty, you know, this does complicate the issue. I mean, for example, you know, we've had cases where, you know, a president will defend at one stage of the case and not at another stage. I remember a case, a lawsuit challenging special treatment given to some Christian Science nurses under Medicaid and Medicare. I can't recall the name of the case, but I know they switched, you know, started defending it and then later on didn't defend it. You know, you also had Metro Broadcasting involving minority preferences for minority-owned stations under the first President Bush, where the administration didn't defend it, but they allowed the FCC to go ahead and defend. So, you know, there's you know, it's not quite a binary situation. I just felt I should point that out. I don't know if the call is still on, but did he want to repeat his second question that we didn't understand?
Yeah, sure. Let me just take one more shot at that and from a different direction. In order to about the cases which are transparently unconstitutional, which I think was one of the arguments being made here, does it make sense to actually involve the judiciary in making that determination along the lines of what would be a preliminary injunction type of standard, which would be to the effect of a substantial likelihood on the success on the merits of that argument?
Are you saying that the administration, before it can decide not to defend, would have to go to court to get a quick ruling on whether the law really is transparently unconstitutional?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
You know, I mean, that's certainly not the way it's been done in the past, and I guess I'm not inclined to sort of change the structure of the judicial system, you know, to accomplish that. How about you, Neil? How do you feel about that?
Well, my view is that if, you know, the Justice Department considers the law transparently unconstitutional, there would be no duty to defend. And there are cases that actually Cy and I detail in our piece where you have some instances where the Supreme Court has ruled directly on the issue, or seemingly directly on the issue, but there's still a case filed, and there the government won't defend the statute, and it will notify the Congress that the court has essentially closed the issue out by some related ruling. I have no problem with the administration refusing to defend in those circumstances, so long as they think that the court's ruling was correct. Obviously, if they think the court's ruling was incorrect and a defense can be launched because the court was wrong, I'd be all for the government launching that defense in that circumstance.
I think Neil and I agree on this. You know, even though I'm skeptical of how presidents use the exceptions, I don't want to really take it out of their hands and force them to go to a court to get some sort of advisory opinion on whether it's unconstitutional enough that they cannot defend it.
Let me make another call for questions here. Our lines are completely open now. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left. Push the star button, the pound button if you have a question. If not, let me ask a question that may be directed to Kurt Levy on adversity. Where exactly does adversity need to lie? It seems to me that in a lot of Supreme Court cases, for example, there's representation by an attorney who might or might not believe in the cause of his client, but he or she is merely putting forth the best arguments. I think that probably happens all the time. Why can't somebody in the executive do that, even if they don't believe, personally in the arguments? And if they're doing that, does that mean there's no true adversity and the adversity requirement's not met?
Well, I'm not an expert on justiciability. Again, my understanding is that just having a special counsel doesn't satisfy it. Blag, which was the House group that defended it, that even that was a close call. I think it was 6-3 saying that, that gave us adversity. And if you look at the language that, there were a number of opinions in Windsor, and if you look at the language, it's somewhat different from justice to justice, but I came away from that sort of more confused about the doctrine than clarified. I mean, it seemed like a lot of mumble jumble to me. Maybe Neil, did you understand?
The court certainly did not rule on whether the House could intervene, and that was quite confusing on that point. I agree with you; it was very indeterminate. I think Justice Kennedy's principal argument on why there was a dispute was an argument based on the fact that Windsor was being denied her benefit, and by enforcing the law, she had a claim against the government, and the government wasn't backing away from its decision to enforce the law, so there was a justiciable dispute for that reason. And then the question was, who would stand in and represent the government in the case? But again, I think there is past precedent for the court appointing counsel to stand in for a party when there's a live dispute, but no one willing to argue the government side. This happened actually in the Bob Jones case as well, where, as some people may recall, the Reagan administration concluded that Bob Jones was entitled to its tax-exempt status, notwithstanding its policy of prohibiting interracial dating on campus. And the government in the Justice Department was unwilling to defend the previous governmental policy. And the tax break, however, was not given to Bob Jones, notwithstanding that, for very complicated reasons that I won't get into. But the court said, the government, Justice Department, won't defend the government's policy, so we're going to appoint William Coleman as counsel to represent the government's policy before us, and that's how the case proceeded, with Bob Jones being represented by famous religious liberty lawyer William Ball, and the government's view being represented by William Coleman. And strangely enough, the government in the form of the Reagan administration appeared as amicus in his own case, claiming that Bob Jones was correct. In any event, this is a very long way of saying that the adversity issue sometimes can be solved by the appointment of these counsel.
And again, I think we agree. In many or most cases, you can solve it. But I pointed out the Windsor case just to point out that, that there are cases where you won't get constitutional adjudication because the administration isn't defending. And I was just saying that Windsor was a close call, you know, that it was a 6-3 vote on the issue and that, you know, there may not have been a House blag if the district court had not allowed them to intervene. So that was my only point.
Very good. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there, gentlemen. I want to thank you both on behalf of the Federalist Society. Certainly appreciate it. I think this has been a very, very interesting discussion, as evidenced by the audience questions. And to our audience, thank you for calling in, and thank you for your questions. A reminder to check the Federalist Society's website for our next scheduled telephone conference call. But until that call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.